life,
dignity,
security,
freedom,
respect,
justice,
equality,
equality,
remedy,
succession,
fairness,
fair time,
Right.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum,
identity,
family,
home,
conscience,
expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
leisure,
health,
education,
culture,
human rights,
Sardana,
solidarity.
Fill in the border. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sasktel Max at Channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at Channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. I'm Jim Hutchings, and I've got two special guests. First one is Brad Bellegarde, who's a member of the committee organizing the Decolonizing Media event, and Naomi Weingessner, who is an organizer of the Community-Based Research Showcase. And Naomi is going to join me later on. And Brad is up first. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And it's good to have you here. And you're also a journalism student.
That is correct.
At U of R. And tell us about the event that you have taken part in organizing.
Well, we're at a very crucial time in our society right now, speaking generally for Canada itself, when we take a look at the Eurocentric philosophies that are still very, very relevant in today's society. So we wanted to be able to organize something where we can take a look at and critically analyze the idea and environment of the media. How do we decolonize? I know that a lot of institutions across Canada are looking at indigenizing themselves, but at the same time, we need to take a look at that other side of the equation and look to decolonize the colonialism that exists right now. And the media is a frontline outlet for individuals to be able to express themselves and tell stories. And if we can help to put a little dent in that colonialism by decolonizing just for our community's sake, I think that it'll go a long way in the future.
Well, I'm just wondering how you would answer this question. How does a colonized media exhibit itself? What are the symptoms? I mean, probably there are lots of people, myself included, will say, what are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. and definitely, like, it all starts with, for me personally, the identifier is myself, my identity itself. Do I recognize myself as a Canadian citizen or a First Nations person or an Aboriginal person? There's all these terms that were put forth to colonize individuals and being the first peoples of the country that we call Canada now, we need to take a look at how can we instill that identity into recognizing them as their own groups of individuals, you know, rather than always lump something people together in one term, I guess, like, for example, Aboriginal. Mm-hmm. I identify myself as a First Nations who is Nakota Cree. So in Indigenous terms, I'm representing only two identities, as opposed to the over 50 identities that we have for Indigenous peoples across Canada. So it's a big task to try to decolonize, but the importance of this event is to bring actual Indigenous individuals who have worked in the media or currently working in the media to have some kind of dialogue revolving around how we can take some new ideas and bring them into the environment of the media, whether it be news, print journalism, filmmaking. There's all forms of media now.
Mm-hmm.
And without there being any racial tension, because I think it's important to recognize it like that. So there is the idea behind instilling that identity and recognition and accepting new ideas that can move forward to better our environment and better our country.
Now, it makes me wonder, like, as we start this conversation, I wonder if our colonized media has an agenda that we're, you know, the great unwashed out here. We don't know what that agenda is, and we think that everything is kind of benign. And agenda? What agenda? Do they have an agenda? Is it something we should be concerned about? What sort of things? How are we being affected by the media that we're experiencing?
Yeah, and I think we're at a very important time right now when it comes to media, because we have this huge world of social media, which is putting a dynamic twist on how people look for different types of information, whether people are going on Twitter, Facebook, all these different forms of social media are really engaging a lot younger, a younger demographic, in order to be able to speak and have discussions and create some dialogue revolving around what they perceive to be real or critically analyze it. And I think a great example is when I was younger, when I grew up in the 80s and 90s, a news headline would start by saying an Aboriginal male or an Aboriginal female or a First Nations male, rather than, and then when there's a victim of crime, nobody says right away it was a Caucasian male. You know, like that little piece of information right there tends to bring a little bit more attention towards the cause or the case or the problem that's actually happening in society in general. And by identifying that individual just as a First Nations or Aboriginal, that's still being colonial. You know, you don't hear them saying a 38-year-old male, whatever it may be.
Right.
It's a 38-year-old Aboriginal male.
Right, right. It's interesting how the event is framed says a lot about the attitude that is being brought to it and how we're supposed to think about it. But it's interesting you bring up social media. It makes you wonder now how relevant things like radio and TV news are now, because, I know people, family members actually, that they don't want to listen to the news anymore because it upsets them. And they find that, I feel a lot better during my day if I don't watch the news. That's great, yeah. But a lot of our news now, of course, is coming to us via social media. And we can choose then what slant we want. And that's kind of disturbing as well, because sometimes I think a group or an individual person could use a little kick in the behind, but he's not going to get it if he's already tuned into the media that he wants to listen to.
Exactly. Exactly. It kind of like opens up a door for you get to pick and choose what you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether, and I think that a lot of people had recognized that throughout this election that just happened. Their news feeds were showing a lot of support for probably more often, more so than often, one party because their group of friends are all sitting on that same side.
Right.
So it was a unique dynamic to be able to watch this election unfold without looking. Like, I tried to stay off the social media in order to be able to step back from it, because obviously my views are going to be my friends and those who I surround myself with all identify as First Nations people. And it's going to be heavily filled with individuals talking about, well, which party is going to be supporting Aboriginal rights and First Nations rights and the treaties and implementing more treaty promises. So I watched it from the outside, and it was really unique, because some people's feeds were talking about the wrongs that one party did or what one party has promised, and the social media gives that opportunity for individuals to be able to express themselves openly.
Right.
So I think some may call, like, some members of the media may consider social media being an obstacle or being creating, I guess, making it harder for the media to be able to do the job that they initially set out to do. And actually, what I see is an opportunity to be able to organize.
Right.
Organize individuals to come to events and set up events, because decolonizing the media, we need to decolonize everything in our environment. But where do we start? As a journalist, as a journalism student, I think that it's important for us to be able to start with the media.
Right. Two things are spinning around my head here right now. And one is, I'm just wondering how much you talk to people about the election, about issues prior to the election. And but let's go with that, and then I'll see if I can remember my next thought. Did you spend much time talking to people about issues, and would you be talking more with Aboriginals than or with colonists, let's say? What kind of conversations did you have running up to the election?
Well, you know, as an Indigenous person, I think that one major question that a lot of people had that are Indigenous was the validity of voting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it was the course of action to take to create change or not voting, because historically speaking, the government's agenda has been to assimilate First Nations people and Indigenous people into the environment to be Canadians first before they represent who they are.
Right.
So
right.
that was a conversation that I did actually have with a few individuals, and just to see what their perception of it is.
Right.
Like, is there an agenda to assimilate First Nations people into being Canadian? Like, that's a valid question, because when we look at colonialism and the history of First Nations people in itself, there were treaties signed from 1871. Like, there was 11 numbered treaties. But in 1876, they signed Treaty Number 6, but they also implemented the Indian Act. So there's, on one hand, you have the relationship with the Crown, and on the other hand, you have the relationship with the Canadian federal government. So those are two very different things.
Yeah. It's a conversation that has been lacking for years and years and years, and is coming to the fore now, and I think a lot of people are... They're being educated. They never realized, I don't think, just what the relationship was, and things like, when did First Nations get the vote? Well, it really wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, 1960.
Yeah,
good. The first election was 61.
John Diefenbaker.
Yeah.
So there's been a lot of things happen in the recent past. You know, in my lifetime. That you would think would have happened long before, but no.
Yeah, and I think also something that we can notice happening right now is the obvious population surge with First Nations people, the fastest growing demographic in the country. They're all internet savvy. They all know how to utilize social media. And this is actually the first generation that we're seeing where First Nations people are not silenced for saying things. Residential schools just closed in the 90s. You know, that's like, what, 20 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
So there is a huge dynamic happening right now within Indigenous communities. And when I was growing up in elementary school, I was the minority.
Mm-hmm.
Now I visit community schools, and if an indigenous people are the majority. So we're seeing a huge shift in people being given the ability to be able to express themselves and talk about what's really problematic in their communities. And it's very important to be able to step back and take a look at how society is changing in our community.
Yeah, we'd better get those communications channels open.
Yeah, so if we can start educating children right now that are like 7, 8 years old about residential schools. I know that that didn't even come up in my classes when I was in school. And to think about that, and when I was in high school in the 90s, it was very rare that you would hear somebody talking about residential schools. One really big one was my Native Studies teacher. He was Métis. He identifies himself as Métis.
Mm-hmm.
How he spoke passionately about Louis Riel and how it was a resistance, not a rebellion. That's a colonial statement right there.
Right.
The resistance of 1886, you know, or 1885, that's identifying as empowering.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you call it a rebellion, that's a colonial mindset. They were rebelling against who? Against the Europeans, against the Canadian government. Why? Because of identity problems.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all these topics that are now openly being discussed with youth, and I think it's great because what it does is it empowers individuals with knowledge about Canada's history, but it also prevents future discussions that may be considered racist or may be considered detrimental to one ethnic background or one ethnic group, because the more that you can learn at a young age, the easier you're going to be able to work with people in the future. And by the looks of the demographic and how fast First Nations people are actually growing population-wise, there's a very high chance that you're going to be working with an Indigenous person in the future. So
yeah, and you know, looking at the positive side here, it's part of the curriculum now. Curriculum,
yes,
in public schools. So young students are getting the opportunity to learn about treaties and First Nations and that sort of thing. Very early, one of my daughters and my daughter-in-law took Cree when she was at First Nations University.
Yeah, we're seeing a high population of non-Indigenous people taking Cree.
Yeah,
which is very cool to see that. Like I actually graduated with the INCA certificate at First Nations University of Canada. I'm currently the president of the Student Association. And every year we see more and more non-Indigenous people coming to our institution, which is great because the purpose of our institution isn't just for First Nations people. It's for everyone to come and learn about First Nations people situated right here in Treaty 4 territory. So I think it's remarkable to see that non-Indigenous people taking Indigenous language classes.
That final thought that was spinning around in my head here, and I'm just going to say it, maybe we're getting close to the time when we want you to do a little performance for us, but I was thinking to myself, you know, maybe it would be worthwhile for a person to purposely pick different news sources that are going to be in some ways maybe opposing each other or giving you different perspectives. Like maybe I'd want to hear what Ezra Levant has to say about something.
Oh, yeah. I'd love to sit down with Ezra.
That sort of thing. But make sure that you've got a rounded collection of news sources so that you're getting all sides.
Yeah, I think that's very important. So I would really want to encourage individuals that are interested more in this topic to come out to our event that's happening November 5th, Thursday night at the Royal Saskatchewan Museum. We have a list of very, very well-rounded journalists that are coming, that are actually active journalists or have been former journalists coming to sit on our panel. It's going to be moderated by Dr. Shawneen Pete, who's the Indigenization Lead at the U of R. And I just want to say it's really important that people recognize the amount of work that goes into organizing something like this and recognition of the Regina Public Interest Research Group, ARPERG, at the U of R for kicking in and helping us financially a little bit. I think it's important to recognize those individuals. And we really just want to have a really good event where people could come out and openly discuss some topics and get a little bit more knowledge from the perspective of an Indigenous journalist who is working in a mainstream media organization.
Well, and we'll be talking more about that event in the next half hour, but you're not going to be with us. You've got
I have to go back to the university.
So in the meantime, you're going to do a little performance for us here. Are you all set to go? Do you want to set it up, or do you want to talk about it after?
Yeah, we can set it up right now. Okay. We've just been discussing topics about colonialism and there were different policies that were implemented by the federal government. One of those policies was the residential school policy, and this is a song that I wrote based on sitting down with my parents who went to residential school for over 10 years, both of them, my uncles. I spoke with them and got their experience, and which is a very common experience for a lot of residential school survivors to remember their first night. So this is a song that I wrote in a story form of the first night.
Okay, here we go.
It's called I Remember. And I want to dedicate it to all residential school survivors, those who've been affected, children, grandchildren. It's for you. I was playing outside, just a little man, with the world in the palm of my hand. A little kid living life with innocence. I remember everything with images. A red truck and a man in a black robe. They told my mom, call him Father Joe. So we called him Father Joe. I saw a tear in my mother's eye. I let out a cry, but I didn't know why. Piled up in the back of a truck, it had a flatbed on it and the road was rough. My hands are shaking, feeling sick to my stomach. Where are they taking us? Who could have done it? My body is nervous. Why am I leaving? What is the purpose? What is the reason? Now I'm just a lost little kid looking for my mother in this life that I live. All alone on the road that I'm traveling, and all I really want to do is just go home. I remember walking through the doors of the school. It was cool in September. They gave us clothes, put numbers on my sweater, said this'll be your name till you're home in December. They put powder on my head, threw me in the shower, then lined us up for bed. They took my braid away. They took our braids away.
When I see you taken away, my heart becomes displaced. With broken shadows, no time for fate. I'll never see you again. I know I'll never see you again. I know I'll never see you again.
Cold night, feeling shackled in my bed. I remember hearing whimpers from the kids, whispers across the room, talking things like, I hope we go home soon. And this is just the first night in my life. I think this is my worst night. I'm just a kid and they're testing my will. When we hear the jingle of the keys, we'd all lie still. I close my eyes just to block out where I'm living, with an image on a cloud that I'm sitting. I wanna fly away. I wanna fly away. I can't cry, I can't sleep. They even took away a kid for trying to speak. I remember thinking that we'd never get to meet. Then my mind drifted off and fell asleep. My first morning brought food I couldn't eat, and if we didn't, we'd get punished in a seat. This is the life that I had to live in residential school as a kid. Now with 60 years later looking back, kinda funny how my mind remembers that. All the little things that I can't forget, but I'm thankful that I made it every step. And through the years, confronted so many fears, my feelings have been adjusted, I'm telling it to your ears. The elements of my tears are sentiments of the years that I spent with my peers. I remember.
Displaced with broken shadows, no time for fate. I'll never see you again. I know I'll never see you again. I know I'll never see you again.
All right.
Wow. Thanks very much, Brad.
No problem. I just want to give a shout-out to the Decolonizing the Media organizing crew, my professor, Patricia Elliott, and Josh Campbell, and everybody that got involved and everybody that pitched in to help. I think it's going to be a great event, and I really encourage anybody that has some time to come out Thursday night. Please do.
Yeah, I was just looking at the list of participants, and starting off with Dr. Shauneen Pete, and you've got Noel Starblanket there as well. Noel's been on our show before.
Yes.
Great guy. And all kinds of interesting people to listen to, and there's going to be participation as well, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think we'll just call it quits there, and because we're just about at the bottom of the hour. Thanks so much. I'd have to make one more comment here. For a long, long time, I didn't like rap.
Wow. I hope I changed that.
Until I heard you.
Yay.
And that was a while ago. So
thanks
for being here, Brad.
You're welcome.
Okay. All right. We'll get things going, and we'll talk to Naomi here in just a moment. And we're back, and you're listening to Human Rights Radio. I'm Jim Hutchings. We were just listening to Brad Bellegarde, and he's off to do something else. But we have with us now Naomi Beingessner. And she is going to talk to us about sort of the larger event, the event that Brad is concerned with. Is going to kick off you're going to have to help me out here. Community-based research showcase.
There you go. Yeah, that's not the catchiest title.
Tell us what's going to happen at this showcase.
Sure. Like you said, the decolonizing media event the night before is kind of an opening. So talking about the democratization of media, and as Brad was kind of mentioning, we saw maybe the opposite of that in the last election, where you had newspapers coming out and endorsing candidates against the will of journalists who worked for those papers. We are shifting the focus a little onto, I guess, the democratization of research that is from the community, in the community, for the community, responding to community needs. I don't know what people think of when they think of research at the U of R, but I think a lot of people would kind of think of labs, right? They'd think of maybe psychological research. They'd think of maybe some research towards corporate ends, that kind of thing. The Community Research Unit, which I am the coordinator of at the moment, kind of flips that around. So what we do is we ask community organizations to come to us with their research needs. We'll hook them up with any assistance that we can offer that they might need, whether that's a student who has the time and ability to carry out some research for them, whether that's faculty members who can advise on the best ways to do research project. We even have a small fund so we can give funding to community organizations who have research needs. And a lot of organizations maybe don't see themselves as having research needs, but once they kind of hear about the kind of things we do and see what other people are doing, there is a lot of work that we can do that people often don't have time for in their day-to-day job. They're trying to meet immediate needs. They're trying to get things done. And we can kind of help out and do some of that work, that background work that's really nice to have. Now, I'm being really vague. It would help to give you some specific examples, wouldn't
okay.
it? we have 15 presentations at the showcase, and the ones I can kind of talk about a little more are a couple that are projects that we have or are helping facilitate. So one of the projects, for example, is a project that we have with Stops to Violence and also the Saskatchewan Prevention for the Cruelty of Animals. Stops to Violence, of course, does a lot of work with organizations who deal with interpersonal violence and abuse. And what they were finding when talking to people who are in these situations, maybe trying to get out of an abusive situation, is that one of the barriers that keeps people from leaving and that really isn't well provided for in Saskatchewan is that often people have pets mm-hmm. that they're very close to, emotional support animals, or they have livestock that are a part of their livelihood, and they mm-hmm. can't leave these animals behind. They don't know if they'll be cared for. They might actually have received threats against those animals should they leave. So the research project we're doing with them is to find out what supports could there be for people in this type of situation. What can organizations do to help out if they have a person who comes to them and has this barrier to leaving? So we kind of hooked up the organizations with a graduate student researcher who is conducting interviews to kind of figure out, you know, the first step. Let's identify what exists out there and let's see what the needs are, and then where can we go from this as far as policy and resources and get some action on that. Another project that we're going to be showcasing is with Regina Fire and Protective Services, and it has been in the news a little bit. they wanted to find out who they should target with an education campaign about cooking fires. Cooking fires are the number one reason that the Fire and Protective Services are called out, and they take a lot of resources. They've taken lives in the past couple of years. There have been some pretty horrific situations.
Yep.
So
just recently, actually.
Yeah. I think not too far from here on Winnipeg Street, too.
Yeah.
And then the big apartment fire on Parliament. Yeah, luckily no one died in that one, but it destroyed the entire building. So in order to kind of best target education, they came to us, and a faculty member from sociology designed a survey that the fire captains take on an incident and fill out. And from that, you'll have to wait for the full report, but there have been some trends identified in what kind of cooking leads to more severe cases. Maybe what are the characteristics of people? I can give you a little spoiler here, which we thought was interesting, is that when people fall asleep when cooking, it's usually men. And they're usually cooking pizza. So think about that, and next time you pop a pizza in the oven. So
I imagine deep fat frying's not good either.
Yes, deep fat frying. Yep. I mean, some of these answers we know, but need, you know, verification and statistical data. But some of them are a bit surprising.
Hmm.
I think people have some assumptions about who is causing these fires, and those assumptions are not always borne out. I know when I had an incident that I had to have the fire department come out to, it was when I was a new mom. You know, you don't get a lot of sleep. You're a bit stressed out. I was home alone with the kids. I put some squash in the oven and went outside to play with the kids.
Oops.
Yeah. Then the smoke detector and the alarm was hooked up directly to the fire department. So came, but it was a bit embarrassing. But that is a demographic that gets distracted.
Sure.
And those incidents happen.
You got lots on your plate.
Yes, exactly. So part of the event is the showcase of these types of presentations, but another part of the event is kind of an attempt to make collaboration between the university and communities easier. This is the second time we've done this showcase, and last year around this time, when we were putting on for the first time, we knew the community was doing research and that not enough people were hearing about it. And kind of vice versa, that we were doing projects that people would be interested in and weren't hearing about. But we also knew that there was just a big gap in understanding between community and university. And last year at our showcase, we had a bit of a discussion at the end and said, you know, what can we do for you? What are your needs as far as research that the university can help provide? And people said, well, you know, they appreciated the showcase and learning. They also want to know about access to library resources. If they're doing their own research, can they access this wealth of resources at the University of Regina Library?
Mm-hmm.
And they can, to an extent. A lot of the databases you need to actually be on campus to access. But once you are, you go to the library, they have wonderful people who will happily help you, and just a wealth of data. So this year we are trying to, we're going to try to map the connections that people have with the university. So, you know, have you had a prof help you out with a bit of information? Have you had a student in a class volunteer with your organization? Right? Have you received funding from anywhere in the university? Have you donated to the university? All sorts of ways that people could be involved, but that we don't have a real good sense of. And on that map, we'd like to locate the barriers. So how can we do a better job and not just sit in an ivory tower, I guess? And how can we better respond to the needs of the community? The university came out with a new strategic plan, a new 5-year strategic plan not too long ago, and there is an increased emphasis on engagement with the community, serving the community, and responding to the community. And we were pleased to see that, partly because we influenced putting that in, but also because I think that's just so important. That is really important work that we can do and can do well. So,
wow. You know, it occurs to me that this aspect of the university being there as a resource to the public is something that they don't the public doesn't realize, hasn't realized, and it's really always been there.
Yeah.
To some extent, it reminds me of an incident I had. I had some oil that I wanted tested for a certain ingredient, and it's just trying very hard to remember what it was, and I can't remember the letters involved. But anyway, I sent it off to U of S, and I did get an analysis back, and they told me all about it.
Right.
And it's an ingredient in transformer oil.
Oh, okay.
It's not going to come to me. But anyway, the danger I discovered was when you burn it, it becomes furans, which are really toxic, but the actual ingredient in itself aren't. So that stuff I learned.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I decided to do that. I guess I really, really wanted to know. So
yeah.
If somebody really, really wants to know something about a particular topic, they could go to the university and seek out someone who actually is involved in that discipline, and likely is going to find someone who can, if not actually tell you what you need to know, point you in the right direction.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a public institution. It is overwhelmingly taxpayer funded, although tuition is kind of creeping up as a as a source of funding, unfortunately.
Yeah.
There's a mandate there. The motto of the University of Regina is "as one who serves," and I think it's good to keep that in the forefront of people's minds.
Yeah, it's not as much of an ivory tower type of thing as people maybe would like to think it is. Not really. I suppose there's still some aspects, but funding being what it is, it's harder and harder to find funding for the more esoteric stuff that, it could be argued, really doesn't affect the average person very much.
It is. I mean, there is a bit of necessity, as you say, in engaging with community to prove relevance. I think there's a, not just a sensitivity around, are we relevant or not, but that's the way the culture's going, right? Prove it. What do you do that's good for good for people?
Right.
And again, is that a bad thing? There are trade-offs for sure. Now something you said made me want to say something, and now it's absolutely gone out of my head. I should have a little notebook here and write it down, I guess. I apologize for that.
No problem. I'm just wondering how much a buy-in do you have from the community in this?
Well, that's a good question. We kind of started the process in early September, and we sent out a call for proposals. Last year, we had limited the presentations entirely to community organizations. Some of them were working with university folks, but most of them weren't. And community members said, that was great, but we also want to hear what you're doing. So this year, we opened it up a little more. So from our presentations, it's a really good mix of community organizations, faculty researchers, both of them together, either of them individually, but all doing work in the community. And we had it at the university last year, which some listeners might know is not the most physically accessible place as far as, the parking. It's far off. You have to wander around a maze to find rooms. If you're not familiar with it, it's a bit daunting. And we thought, let's bring it out into the community this year. So it is at the Cora Ritchie Neighborhood Center. And hopefully that's made it easier for folks to attend. We have, I've been keeping kind of a tally, a registration list tally, and we do have kind of a 50-50 split almost of university folks and community folks. So it's a networking opportunity as well, for sure. And we have had, things come out of the networking. We have a project right now with the SASC Seniors Mechanism that is investigating kind of resources in the Regina-Qu'Appelle Health Region for senior victims of abuse and neglect. What's out there? Are there any specialized resources, or is it just kind of, normal intake? I mean, seniors have, they have special needs, distinct needs for that population, but they also are more prey to different kinds of abuse, like financial abuse, right? So that project came out of the discussion last year of how can we work together to do this, and we have a couple of great faculty advisors who are very involved in seniors' health and a great community partner, and found kind of the perfect grad student as well to work on it. Yeah, you don't know what's possible until you talk to people.
Right.
And that's what we're hoping this will do as well. I mentioned registration, and I, as an event organizer, I try to make it seem really imperative that you, get on it right now, register right now. This is exciting. This is important. If you've seen posters or the Facebook page or anything like that, you'll notice there is a registration date that was Wednesday. that was just to scare you all. You can still register. If you want lunch, though, you have to register before Monday morning when I send in my catering order.
Right, right.
It's an all-day event from about 8:30 to 4, but folks are free to come to one session, more than one, whole day, half day. It's
sort of come and go.
Yeah, whatever suits your needs, really.
Right.
Our schedule is online on our website, so you can look at the topics that interest you and decide if you'd like to come out.
Awesome. I'm just wondering whether part of your motivation in getting something like this going is our previous government seemed to look at universities as a place where you make money. And if they're not making money, then don't expect us to give you money. And I'm just wondering if this is kind of part of a reaction to that thing that, I don't know whether I'm perceiving it correctly or not, but that's kind of the way I think our previous government seemed to look at higher education and learning centers and stuff.
Well, I know there was a comment about sociology, anyway, that was made by our former prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not a flattering description of sociology. Sociology doesn't tend to bring in giant amounts of money, I don't think, to a university. Of course, universities are provincially funded for the most part. So I don't know if I would say that is really a political thing. I think it's just a culture. It's it's a growing culture of, I don't know. How much do you want me to get into it here?
Well, one thing
we
you know,
have a, you know, we have a neoliberal culture where if you don't make money, what are you worth?
Exactly.
Really, we do.
Sure. No, true.
And I find it that a lot of things we do are flipped. We give out money instead of taking in money, which kind of makes people's heads spin a little.
Well, I'd just like to back up here for a little bit and ask you how you got to be where you are.
Me personally?
Yeah, you personally.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Well, it was, you're asking me to reveal my age in a way, because it was a long journey. How did I get to, well, I had another career. I was a high school teacher, and then I had children and did a little bit of traveling and found myself in the lucky position, I guess, of being able to come back to school and do something I was interested in rather than something I had to do to get a job.
Right.
So I came back to the University of Regina and did a master's degree in justice studies. And while I was at the university and kind of getting to know it a little better, I came across the Regina Public Interest Research Group, which Brad referred to, who are a major sponsor of the Decolonizing Media event.
And who are they exactly?
They are a student-run, student-funded center at the university. They've been around since, I think, 2008, 2007. And they have a student board of directors. Their mission is social and environmental justice. And so they have a levy. Every student pays in, I think, $6. And they fund a lot of really valuable projects and research and events out of that. And put on their own projects and educational events and that sort of thing. So I worked for them for a little bit. And in turn, they partnered with the Community Research Unit. And so I kind of slid over into this position from there. The common thread, of course, would be social justice through all of the things I've been doing in the last while. It's, I've been really fortunate, I guess, having a number of jobs that allow me to do something that I believe in, that I think is worthwhile and making a difference. And this is the latest iteration of that.
No telling where you'll go from here.
But yeah, I'm always open to adventure, I think.
Point being, of course, that anybody, anytime, can decide that they want to go in a particular direction, and university is there to help out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've been in this position for about a year and a half, and I'm still learning about really interesting programs going on and things like that. The other day, I thought maybe I should come back and do a biology degree and be a botanist. There's some really cool faculty doing neat things in biology.
Well, back to our event here. What do you think people are going to find most interesting? What I'm presuming you did a little research of your own to see, well, okay, what should we do here that's going to get people's attention and grab their imagination?
That's a good question. If I was a marketing professional, I'd probably have a really ready answer for that. I think I'd have to really encourage people to look at this schedule because there is such a variety of research going on. Personally, I'm really excited to know how the Saskatchewan Archaeological Society got 100 community volunteers out to a dig near Ogama.
Wow.
Just that mobilization of volunteers in mm-hmm. a rural area where there aren't that many people there to mobilize mm-hmm. To do something like that, you know, this archaeology is that it's not forefront in a lot of people's minds, mm-hmm. but obviously there's something there that's really neat.
Oh, yeah.
And they've done a good job on communicating what that is. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to learning about that.
I know of some older people down south where I spent most of my living in Saskatchewan. And I think the two that I'm thinking of are no longer with us, but there was a lot of interest down there. And there was some real, I think for the most part, self-taught experts that could direct you to sites and tell you all about it. And so I would imagine you're going to find more than a few people interested in the archaeological part of Saskatchewan. I've been to Wanuskewin and well, they're talking about making it a World Heritage Site now, I think.
Yeah,
something
I think
like that. So
yeah,
we've got lots of interesting stuff here in Saskatchewan when it comes to archaeology. So good start there.
Yeah. We're not just a flyover province.
No.
If you take a deep look, there's a lot of neat things going on. Yeah.
What else do we have there that might pique people's interest?
Well, we actually have, I don't know, if people think of research, they think of, you know, maybe something that's a little dry and results in reports or papers and nothing all that interesting. But one of our sessions is actually with a group of student researchers from the center of the Big Sky Center for Learning and Being Astonished. So it's an organization that is committed to working in inclusive community to address barriers facing young adults who have complex physical disabilities. So a group of these students wanted to explore accessibility and inclusion within the University of Regina because they're students there. So what they did was they took photographs with iPads, they recorded conversations, and kind of combined the words and the images that to them said either, you know, is this including me or is this excluding me? You know, is this including mm-hmm. us or not? And they kind of put music to that, and they've come up with a digital story that I think will be really illuminating, right? I mean, they could have, I suppose, written an article about it, but to be able to see the words and the images and hear the music, I think will be a lot more powerful and make it a lot more immediate for mm-hmm. people so mm-hmm. that they can really, you know, have a bit of that experience of how it feels.
Awesome. What else have we got?
I think you're telling me I've talked too fast.
I want to know what's going on here.
Yeah. Well, at our unit, one of the things I've noticed in the past year is we have a lot of community organizations wanting to know about topics that have to do with newcomers to the city. We have had an increase in immigration from other countries.
Absolutely.
And people coming yep. here. And
hot topic right now, really.
It is, yeah. So one of the people who contacted me and wanted to present is from the Regina Region Local Immigration Partnership. And they wanted to know, you know, what do we have in the community? What kind of assets do we have and what kind of gaps related to bringing people in and settling them and integrating them? What should we really be doing to help people live here successfully mm-hmm. when they come from a different place?
Sure.
So they're going to present on that. And they have just, when they submitted their presentation, they just teased me, so I don't know what the answers are.
Uh-huh.
But I'm curious about that. You know, how can we help people mm-hmm. Feel at home here?
Awesome. Yeah. I think I'm really intrigued by the overall sort of purpose of this, which I see as the university going out, leaving the campus and going to the people
mm-hmm.
and giving them a university experience. And I think there are a lot of people that right from the get-go when they go to school, maybe what their parents, maybe they don't tell them this, but university's not in your future, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah,
you're not a university kid. If you do anything, you're going to go to technical school or whatever mm-hmm. and figure out a way to make a living. Forget about university. That is not for you.
Yeah.
And I think a gathering like this is going to make people realize that there's way more to university. It's not as ivory tower as some people think it is.
Yeah.
And it's just, okay, if you haven't found your way to the campus, all right, the campus is going to find you.
Yeah, I think that's important. University is not just for a select elite at all. Mm-hmm. It's for people of many different interests, many different skills and abilities, and yeah, there is something for everybody. I don't know if I think there has been a bit more attempted outreach. There's science series in pubs, science talks of interest. Education does talks at La Bodega. We're trying to get out there.
Pique some interest, and again, I guess at this point I can ask you, what is your sort of ultimate goal here? What do you hope to, at the end of the day, when you've had your you've had your event and everything, what do you hope to have achieved?
I hope that I will have a number of people coming up to me and saying, okay, how can we do this? How can we have a research project with you? I hope that I will have seen and heard from other people who have talked to each other and said, I didn't know this was going on. This will really help me do X, Y, Z. I'm so glad I met this person here doing this thing. It's, again, hard to measure. And I can't say, well, this event brought in several thousand dollars worth of projects, and we had a 68.4 satisfaction rate, that sort of thing.
Right.
But qualitatively, what would be a success for me, is the networking and the sharing of ideas and just people saying, wow, I learned a lot.
It makes me think, I get little flashes as we go along here. And I can think of one person in particular who, for various reasons, was homeless.
Mm.
And I know she spent time at the university. She would go up and make use of the computers up there, type of thing. And probably it was a good place to stay warm as well.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I can tell, she was welcome there.
Oh, yeah, I think so,
And I think that's another aspect, too. The people that go up to the university, they're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be a certain kind of person or be a student or a prof or whatever. It's totally open to everyone.
It is, and we want people. We want people to use the library. The computer lab you mentioned, mm-hmm. I know which one it is. It's outside the Students' Union, and it's open to anybody. Please come to the lectures on campus. There's concerts on campus that are just lovely.
Yeah, it's a great place.
And yeah.
Maybe part of, I don't know whether it's possible to publicize these things more. maybe that's something to think about here at CJTR. Maybe we should... We should have some kind of an event calendar that we do on a regular basis. Say, oh, today, don't miss this.
Well, I would not object to that at all. Yeah, I mean, I can't even keep up with the number of things that go on at the university, to be honest. It seems like every week there's several things going on that would be really interesting to go to.
And personally, as time goes on, I find myself going to more things at the university on different things. Like I say, music, theater.
Yeah.
And of course, as a member of Amnesty, we do have some really interesting speakers from that field.
Yes.
That show up occasionally. We've got journalists that show up, the various lectures and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they're all free.
Well,
I shouldn't say they're all free.
Well,
most,
we try.
A lot of things are free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the university also gets to showcase a range of opinions that you might not see otherwise, right? Like there's still, despite the pressure to perform in certain ways and to be accountable to, kind of certain interests, there is that academic freedom that allows a lot of different perspectives to be displayed and then talked about and critiqued. So you're not going to find that a lot of other places. That's still our job, and I think we do it pretty well.
Well, Naomi, believe it or not, we have burned up our half hour. And I'd like to thank you very much for coming here and talking to us on Human Rights Radio.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Hope to see you again.
Okay.
Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness.